I guess might as well get started. If you're here for Remains Talk, that's around the corner. This is operations at small scale. I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of operations at a smaller company, and especially from the point of view from somebody who moved from a larger company. So my name is Elliot Sims. I'm a senior sysadmin at Backblaze. Before that, I was SRE, SRO, cluster ops, and production engineer at Facebook from 2009 to 2015. Bunch of different names, but basically all the same sort of thing, make the stuff work. Gonna go over a few different things, kind of what's different, a little bit about automation, how to evaluate kind of all your different options and the trade-offs at a smaller scale, and then a little bit of specifics for some of the various categories. So what's different about a small company? One of the biggest things is you have to understand everything. At some of the bigger places, you can kind of stay in your little niche and just let somebody else handle the rest of it. But a smaller company, you kind of have to have a little bit of understanding of how everything works. On the other hand, it is actually humanly possible to have an understanding of how all the various systems in the entire company work. Fault tolerance, when you've got, you know, your smallest service might be dozens of servers at a larger place. And so it's pretty easy to kind of, you know, put your foot down and say there are no special snowflakes, no service should ever require that one physical server has to be up all the time. But if you only have a few dozen servers, then it gets a little bit harder to insist on that. And it's pretty much unavoidable. You're gonna have some special snowflakes that paid you at 2 a.m. Which kind of goes into the on-call. You know, at a bigger place, you might have 6 or 7 people working on one particular application. So it's pretty easy to keep a nice big on-call rotation. A smaller place, it's a little trickier. Resources. You know, you can't just grab 100 servers. You don't have 100 servers that are already bolted down and ready to go. Now, granted, you might have to have an argument with the capacity engineering people to larger places still, but there's 100 servers somewhere that are ready to go when you need them. On the other hand, if it turns out your servers need proportionally, you need a lot more servers proportionally than you thought, you're actually in a lot better shape. It's way easier to find, you know, an extra dozen servers someplace. Especially if you're using something like AWS compared to, you know, needing to build an entire new data center to accommodate doubling the size of your service. So more importantly for resources, people and knowledge. You know, if you're working at someplace like Google or Facebook or someplace like that and you have, a question about obscure kernel internals that's causing your service problems, there's a decent chance you can find the guy who has written part of that and just go track him down and ask him your question. He'll know the answer. At a smaller place, if you need an expert on something, you're going to have to become that expert. Just kind of sit down and figure out how all of it works. So I'm sure everybody here has kind of come into some place, looked at an older, more established infrastructure, and thought, what idiot design this? Well, at a smaller place, now it's your turn to be that idiot. That's a plus and a minus, definitely. So scaling, don't build for 1 billion users. There's a lot of advice out there on how to make your service massively scalable and very complicated. And, you know, that's great when you need it, but there's a lot of kind of overhead in building and managing these complex scalable services that you don't really want to build up front. You know, you want to build it before you need it, but not that much before you need it. Even these systems that are built for 1 billion users, in a lot of cases, were built for 100,000 users. And then maybe they were rewritten when it was time for 5 million users, and then, you know, again, when they needed to handle 100 million users. But originally, they were not written for 1 billion users, with the exception of services that came up within an existing large service. So again, because of the lack of people resources, simple and stable becomes pretty important. You can't necessarily, you know, dedicate somebody to doing a deep dive and figure out exactly what went wrong every single time with your cutting-edge software. You're kind of have to just stick with stuff that's already been production tested. And in particular, just because something is production hardened in a single environment, you know, Google or Facebook or something like that, that means it's been very production hardened for their specific set of needs. But as soon as you deviate from that, you might be kind of on your own. So it's definitely best to kind of err on the side of things that multiple other people are using when you can. But there are certain types of automation you should build, even if you have two hosts. Backup. Backup is very important. I might be a little biased considering I work for, but if all of your stuff goes away, that's kind of the end of it. Version control for code, of course, is very important, but also for configuration and configuration management. You know, there's all kinds of configuration management systems with various opinions on which one is best, but any of them is way better than not using one. And then that kind of goes into the CMDB, just something that is your source of truth about what exists and where. In the case of AWS, maybe that's just the AWS console, or maybe it's, you know, just something that says, these are the servers we have, these are the names, these are their IP addresses, you know, this is at least something along the lines of what hardware is in them. Possibly you can add service discovery in there as well, but that's sort of depends on your particular needs. So question is, you know, there's all these different options. How do you decide which to use? Of course, there's the financial costs, both in the amount of money it costs, as well as just the amount of money you're going to have to pay somebody to set it up and maintain it. But also the kind of time cost in person hours and time to market. You know, you might save thousands of dollars going with a particular option. But if it delays your release by 6 months, it's probably not worth the savings. And then last but definitely not least, control of your own destiny. It's something that, you know, if you have a whole bunch of vendor gear that you have no insight into, when it all breaks, it's just a big black box and there's not a whole lot you can do. I mean, you've got an SLA, which is great. You can totally blame somebody else for your outage, but your site is still down. It's just as offline as if you didn't have an SLA. And there's less you can do about it. So hosting kind of affects all your other choices, cloud versus colo versus build, monitoring and paging, network equipment, and then communication coordination. For the hosting, AWS is kind of the default. It's great for scaling. It's pretty complicated, especially if you want to restore your data with Glacier. That billing is interesting. Pretty high operational expenses, really. But nice low upfront costs, which is nice. To some extent, you kind of pick your trade-offs with kind of how much control you have, how much money you pay, versus the amount of work you have to do yourself. You know, you can do Elastic Load Balancer or set up your own software load balancer. Same thing with RDS versus MySQL or something. It's pretty low person hours up front, although a little bit because of the complexity of getting set up as well as the billing and everything. Pretty quick setup. AWS as a whole is definitely pretty reliable, but the individual EC2 instances are not necessarily guaranteed to be so reliable and will sometimes kind of vanish out from under you. I have to admit I don't know a whole lot about how Azure and Google's offerings compare. I think for most cases, they're pretty similar these days. I mean, Azure if you need Windows, of course. So there's also the less cloudy VPS options. You've got you know, places like Linode and DigitalOcean, that sort of thing. It tends to scale in kind of hours or days. You can get more, or when you decide to release some of them, you'll get maybe credit or something that's prorated for the month. But by hours or days rather than minutes. If you do need a fairly set number of servers, you know how many servers you'll need this week, and then next week it'll be a slightly larger number, but pretty similar. It's usually cheaper than AWS, although you may be able to kind of play some shenanigans with AWS's various reserved instances and a lot of extra complexity, but it may or may not be cheaper. The setup and billing is a lot simpler. And they usually care a little bit more about keeping the individual instances up, which can be nice if you don't have very many of them. But on the other hand, it's all on you. There's no, you know, RDS or ELB or any of that stuff to fall back on. If you need a CDN, you need to go find a CDN. DNS, they may provide some basic DNS, but you know, nothing like Route 53. Other option, dedicated server. I don't know why anybody would want a dedicated server these days. It's kind of all the downsides of a VPS, except now you're responsible for that specific piece of hardware, not just a virtual host that can exist on whatever piece of hardware works. The next option is colocation, running a data center space and using your own servers. This is good if you benefit from special hardware. Backblaze actually has our storage pods that save us quite a bit of money, so we mostly go with colo. But if you don't benefit from the specific hardware, it's a little harder to kind of justify, because it's got a pretty high cost up front, really high startup latency, you have to find a DC, you have to physically build out the racks and order the servers and all that. It does give you a lot of control. All the equipment is yours, pretty much other than the power distribution. So whatever you need, you know, whatever the problem is, you kind of know how everything works and have control over it and can fix it yourself. It does have a pretty high initial cost, but over time, the long-term cost can definitely be lower than something like AWS or even a Linode VPS. And then, of course, last option, building your own. If you need to build your own, you already know it. If you're at that point, definitely, unless you're absolutely insane or have very specific needs, you almost certainly don't want to start by building your own data center. And if your very specific needs are also very predictable, you know how much you're going to need for probably the next 3 years or so, really. It's a pretty long timeline on the capacity prediction for that. Monitoring and paging. Don't build your own paging. I mean, unless you're a paging company, in which case, go ahead, build your own paging. But other than that, it's a lot harder than you think, getting the escalation stuff right. You really don't want to track down SMS delivery issues across a bunch of different providers, email delivery issues. And most importantly, when your infrastructure, when everything is broken, it's really nice when the thing that tells you everything is broken is not one of the things that's broken. So just pay PagerDuty or VictorOps or Opsgenie, somebody to do that for you. It's totally worth it. Monitoring, if you're coming, this is a pretty broad topic, actually. It could probably be an hour-long talk by itself pretty easily, but I'll skip through it a little bit here. If you're coming from Facebook or Google, you're probably going to be a little bit sad at the options out there. There's a lot of stuff, and I don't think any of it quite measures up to the in-house stuff of those places. A bunch of different subcategories. There's instrumentation, especially for performance, log analysis, port and health checks, metric collection, metric display, querying and analysis, and alerting. Pretty much most of the products cover some subset of these. I don't know if anything does all of them, and most stuff does at least two of them. So for log analysis, you got Splunk if you've got lots of money. Logly, LogLogic, and SumoLogic if you have less money, but still some. And then if you have time to do it yourself, there is the Elasticsearch, Logstash, and Kibana, the Elk Stack. Port and health check, good old Nagios. It works. It's a pain, but it works. Asinga 2, Zabbix and Zenos, which are kind of a little more all-in-one. And definitely have at least some sort of external monitoring from some place like Pingdom, Alert Site, angry Twitter users. Hopefully that's not the first way you find out about an outage, although it can sometimes be a useful indicator until you get big enough that people are talking about the company all the time on Twitter, or if you have a name that's just happens to be a common word. So metric display, querying, and analysis. Again, Zenos and Zabbix kind of do a little of everything. More recently, there's Grafana, Graphite, and Prometheus. Wavefront.io for kind of the pay somebody else to take care of this option. Some of these have their own backend storage, but if not, there's OpenTSDB and InfluxDB. Like you said, that's enough for an hour-long talk, but that's about all I'll go into for this one since I'm a little bit short on time for that. Networking. Unless you go colo or bill, this is kind of a black box. You pay your provider, and you hope the network works, and you try to work around it when it doesn't. If you build your own, nobody ever got fired for buying Cisco. But if their startup runs out of cash, they're still out of a job. So there's the Cisco. There's also, in addition to Cisco, the kind of traditional options, Juniper, Arista, Extreme, Force 10, which is, I think, Dell now. And then kind of the more in-house-ish option, the white box with third-party software. There's a whole bunch of different vendors that make switches based on Trident Plus, Trident 2, or if you need a lot of bandwidth, Tomahawk chipset from Broadcom. There's probably dozens of vendors that make switches based on these. And you can either use their software, which is probably pretty terrible most of the time, to be honest, or a third-party vendor like Cumulus or Pika 8, or more software-defined networking-ish like Big Switch or Nasira. Or if you're really ambitious, you can go for the FBOSS or MS Sonic, which the MS Sonic is Microsoft's Linux distribution that they have released open source for switches, which I'm still waiting for them to announce that was an April Fool's joke, but it's there. It exists, it's real. And then FBOSS is definitely a good option if you kind of have the, if you can dedicate the tool, somebody to creating the tooling that you need to put around it, it's definitely a good option. But it's definitely designed to be used within an environment where there's a lot of tooling around it to manage it. That may change in the next couple of years. But. Communication and coordination. It's another pretty broad category that I'll kind of go over pretty quickly. In most cases, you probably shouldn't try to build your own here unless you, for some reason, need total control of it. Regulatory requirements, although even then, I think these days there's a lot of vendors who can kind of meet the regulatory requirements. You know, it's the old school option if you do decide to build it yourself. IRC and email, dirt cheap, simple, you know, handle a huge number of people communicating on no hardware. But you should probably outsource this to something like Google, Quip, HipChat, Slack, or Facebook at work. Task bug and incident tracking, there's lots of different options. Basically, figure out your workflow first and then pick the one that matches it. You know, something like Pivotal is very, very agile oriented, and if you're doing the very, very agile oriented workflow, then it's great. And if you aren't, then it's absolutely terrible. The main goal is to just kind of minimize friction. If a whole bunch of people on the team have used a particular thing before, just stick with it. You want to kind of have developers spend as little time as possible dealing with it as opposed to using it. And then, of course, documentation. Google Docs is pretty decent. It's got great search, of course. But a wiki kind of has a little bit more structure to it and has the ability to kind of link back and forth. And a little bit more in the way of editing and editing history, although that's present in the Google Docs as well. And that is the end of my talk. Does anybody have any questions? So the question is, they run into problems where, you know, people use different things for a task and then run into problems merging them together. At a smaller company, it's a little bit easier to kind of keep track of that sort of thing and avoid that sort of drift. It does happen, but it's way easier to catch it early, I would say, and kind of stay on top of that. But yeah, we've had a little bit of problems with people kind of going off and doing their own thing, but again, since it's such a small place, it's usually kind of whichever one gets most momentum, everybody will just switch over to it. And there's, I guess the divergence doesn't last very long.
Do At my last gig, we used Confluence as our wiki solution, and the organization was sort of okay, but it got changed often. It was very difficult to search. Do you have any other recommendations for wikis locally?
I honestly don't. I can say we use DocuWiki, and it kind of generally works, but it's entirely possible that we'll start kind of feeling some growing pains with that. I don't know that the documentation-specific wikis are actually any better for documentation than something general like MediaWiki. Some of that's also just sort of a cultural discipline to, you know, maintain the wiki, and it helps a lot if you've got somebody who sort of makes it their job to make sure it stays organized.
You talked about software and hardware, but not peopleware. So how do you handle recruiting, training, mentorship in such a small environment where you can't promise them the world?
That's a good question. So I will say for recruiting, I think for Backblaze, one of the more helpful things we've had for recruiting is just our blog and kind of general openness. We talk a lot about, yeah, and pretty openly about what we do and what we set up and that sort of thing. And that's definitely helped us a little bit. All the stuff about the Backblaze pods and the vaults and that sort of thing. And more recently, load balancer entry, which might be a little bit biased, but you should go check that one out. And then we also have a pretty active presence, I guess. Well, I should say one guy actually is kind of in charge of the social media stuff and has a pretty active social media presence, which has helped. But yeah, we've definitely struggled to kind of attract people and kind of make people aware when we are hiring that we are hiring. It's also a little tricky because, you know, unlike someplace like Facebook or Google, we're not constantly hiring. You know, we reach a point where we need another person and can afford another person, but that's not constantly true like it is with a larger place. That's a good question. We actually just finally set up a job section. I think it's just backblaze.com/jobs, but I'm not 100% sure about that offhand. I think we're kind of looking a little bit for a network-focused sysadmin, but we may be hitting the end of that search. We'll see. It's definitely a problem. I wish I had a better answer for you, but it's something that we've struggled with a little bit as well. Another thing you can try is maybe you can talk somebody in the company to going and giving a talk at, say, SREcon or something like that, and that might be helpful. The question was, what do we do for business continuity and kind of disaster recovery as a smaller company? That's definitely kind of a hard question. To some extent, you can go with the AWS option and pay the extra money there that sort of forces them to at least deal with the hardware side of the disaster recovery. A lot of it depends on your particular business and what you do, you know. In our case, because we do backups and we control the client, we can kind of tolerate shorter outages pretty well. If we're down for an hour, it just means the backup happens an hour later. Unfortunately, some people may have to wait an hour until their backups are ready. I don't have a great answer for that one either. It just depends. If you can afford to have some sort of disaster recovery, great. That's definitely where the backups come in, so at least you have all of your data and then all of your configuration and all of your code so that you can set something up quickly. You know, even if all your physical hosts go down, maybe you can just set up AWS really fast to get something up and running in the interim. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? So the question was, did the big company bias kind of lead me into any mistakes and that sort of thing? Probably the biggest, I think I mostly managed to sort of catch myself for doing a lot of this, but kind of like I said in the talk, one of the biggest things to adjust to is just the limited resources. You have to accept that, you know, you may not be able to do, you have to pick which cool thing you're going to do and then sort of stick with the tried and true for a lot of the rest of it. And you can't just take on a large project necessarily and expect to have the enough people to do it. That's probably the biggest one. It's just not having those resources. Right. Anything else? All right. I will. So we do a little bit more of a traditional push process. It's just kind of the, and it's definitely sort of a little bit ad hoc and managed by the engineers. It's a small enough place that we can sort of get away without a whole lot of process. And again, also for the more traditional backup product before the B2 cloud stuff, we could get away with a lot because we control the client and it's not particularly, you know, time sensitive down to the millisecond or anything. It's more on a, you know, day-to-day basis rather than per second. So we could get away with quite a bit there. It's become a little bit more formalized. There's like a Thursday push. That's kind of all hands on deck. But for the most part, at a smaller place, you don't need that kind of process yet. If there's no more questions, I guess it's time to head back to the refreshments. Oh, I'm sorry. Got one. No? Yes, no?